Hello and welcome to Monocle 24 is the Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
It's this game of being out there, being in the community, talking to people, getting to know and building trust, and also being here and letting the participants steer the boat. When they're ready, they will come to us.
We're going to look at some of the organisations and activists who are promoting a harm reduction approach to the issue of drugs in our cities by offering social support and attempting to remove the stigma attached to those suffering from addiction. We're going to check in with a syringe service programme in Philadelphia to see how their work is helping disenfranchised people across the city. We're going to speak with a journalist who's released two books highlighting stories from the activists helping people with addictions. And we're going to investigate how New York's controversial new safe injection sites are fitting in to their communities or not. All that coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. The topic of how to deal with drugs in our cities is a contentious one, but with the United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention reporting a steady rise in overdose deaths in the country over the past decade, it's an important topic too. Many are calling the situation in the US an overdose epidemic, with those addicted often graduating from prescription painkillers to heroin and, more recently, to fentanyl, a much stronger and more dangerous opioid. In 2020, overdose deaths in Philadelphia alone hit a record high, and fentanyl was involved in 81% of them. While America's war on drugs focused largely on locking up drug offenders, it's done little to prevent drug use and has cost the country financially too. This high cost and the low reward has seen many organisations and activists focus instead on a harm reduction approach, attempting to save both lives and healthcare costs. But this approach is not without its detractors. Many believe that needle exchanges and supervised consumption sites do little more than enable drug users and also invite drug-related crime into neighbourhoods. On today's episode, we wanted to explore this approach by speaking to some of the people involved in these programmes to see how this radical attempt to change how we deal with drugs might also be a lifesaver for cities. I'm joined firstly today by Travis Lupik, who's the author of Fighting for Space, and also more recently, Light Up the Night. Travis's books show the extent of the overdose crisis in North America by telling the stories of the activists helping people with addictions use drugs safely, reduce harm, and also live with some dignity. I spoke to Travis a few days after the release of Light Up the Night, and I began by asking what he explores in both this and his previous release.
Yeah, Fighting for Space was a book I saw published in 2018 that recounted Vancouver, Canada's history with harm reduction. It's a grassroots story of establishing needle exchange and supervised injection facilities in North America, really much earlier than most other cities. And that story was really compelling to me because those accomplishments were very much the work of grassroots activists, actually people who used drugs, many people who were homeless, really an inspiring story of empowerment. Light Up the Night is just out this week. And though it takes place in a very different geographic area, the United States, as opposed to Vancouver, Canada, it in many ways continues that story of grassroots harm reduction, sort of continuing the narrative chronologically, picking up where Fighting for Space left off, but transplanting the story to the United States, focusing on two really amazing women, Jess Tilley in Massachusetts and Louise Vincent in North Carolina, two drug user organizers, people who use drugs, people who are sort of turning other drug users into activists in the same tradition of Vancouver, working at places like Needle Exchange and working to establish things like supervised injection across the United States.
And tell me, what drew you to this very big, ongoing, complicated story? You've talked there about some of the things that are happening in Vancouver, but what caught your attention here as a journalist?
This all sort of began in 2015, 2016, when I was working as a general assignment reporter for a newspaper in Vancouver. And we noticed that overdose deaths were climbing really quickly in our city, in Vancouver. Later, we learned that fentanyl, a synthetic opiate, significantly more dangerous than heroin, had arrived. And over the next 4, 5, 6 years, slowly, gradually, incrementally, essentially transplaced heroin. And really sent overdose deaths just skyrocketing. There's a rough annual average in the province of British Columbia of 200 deaths a year from 2000 to 2010. And that figure jumped to nearly 2000 deaths this year. So, you know, there's a time frame we're working with there that's over a decade long, but you know, a tenfold increase in overdose deaths is what Vancouver has experienced. And that's what really drew me to this story, because I found that harm reduction was a really incredible response to this overdose crisis. Places like Needle Exchange, where drug users could access medical treatment and even doorways to treatment. And Vancouver has even more radical harm reduction programs, such as supervised injection, the continent's first, and then even more radical programs than that. In Vancouver, we have the continent's only prescription heroin program. So that's what drew me to the story of harm reduction, is the overdose crisis. And then getting to the second book, Light Up in the Night, that problem I found is even more acute in the United States. In the 12-month period ending May 2021, there was a record 100,000 deaths across the continent. And that 100,000 compares to about 15,000 annually, about 25 years earlier. So similar to Vancouver, just a shocking increase in overdose deaths.
We've seen much debate around the companies that help trigger this opiate issue. But tell me, who gets swept up in this drug use? Is it normally people who turn to it through recreational use, or people who started taking drugs for a medical reason who then get hooked on these drugs? What's the kinds of people that you're coming across in this crisis?
The short answer is everybody. You know, especially where I lived for many years in Vancouver, everybody I know knows somebody who has died of an overdose. It started out, you know, everybody knows somebody who has known somebody, and now it's everybody knows somebody. There was a prominent judge in Vancouver who died of a fentanyl overdose in his car. As a journalist, many of my reporter friends have had family members pass away and have spoken publicly about that. And then, of course, you know, it is affecting your more stereotypical sort of down and out drug user who's ended up homeless on the street. That community has been very badly affected across North America. But this is really a problem that is affecting everybody. You alluded to pharmaceutical companies and the role that they've played in this crisis. And they really, in the early 2000s, late 1990s, just flooded the continent with highly addictive prescription painkiller pills, OxyContin being the best known, and Purdue Pharma being the best known company. And that brought this problem into the home of quote unquote ordinary Americans right across the country. So it's a problem that's affecting every household you can think of.
Just tell me another piece of background here. You obviously, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when we saw crack in our cities, and the response to that was tough and harsh from both civic authorities and national governments, you know, especially in the US, this notion of really criminalizing everyone who got caught up in that process. Is that still the way that much of the law system responds now to when they find people using opiates, or is it so widespread that it's forced even the legal system to readjust a little bit?
The best known sort of accepted narrative that's developed here in North America is that law enforcement's response to this opiate crisis has been very different from the previous response to crack cocaine, you know, in the 1980s, early 90s. And again, the dominant narrative says that is largely because of race. The crack cocaine problem of the 1980s was largely a black problem. And so police came in with billy clubs and guns in many cases, and really just sort of occupied neighborhoods and got this really terrible, very violent war on drugs going. That's all true. The opiate crisis began, although it's not a white problem anymore, it began in North America as a white problem with prescription pills. And so we found government's response was very different. All of a sudden, we're talking about addiction as a disease and how we need compassion, not police. And that's true, too. And that difference is heavily rooted in race and racism in America, but also in Canada. Where I'll diverge from that accepted narrative, which, again, is largely true, is that the war on drugs is not softening to the degree that I think most people think it is. One of the subjects I spend a lot of time in Light Up the Night talking about is the development of a drug-induced homicide charge, a new legal instrument that's developed in response to the fentanyl crisis. And it says, if you give someone drugs and that drug turns out to be fentanyl and that person dies, you are going to jail, and you're going to jail for a long time because we're charging you with murder. You're not drug dealing, you're not trafficking, you're a murderer. And it's a law that was designed for dealers, maybe good intentioned. That's not how it's been used. We've seen majority of cases, actually, where drug-induced homicide is used to charge a girlfriend who gives their boyfriend drugs that they don't know are fentanyl, or for a brother who gives their brother drugs that turn out to be fentanyl that they didn't know about. It's turning one tragedy into two, when someone dies and then their relative goes to jail having no idea what they did. The war on drugs has softened in some ways. We are seeing mandatory minimums come down in response to this opiate crisis. And We are seeing addiction talked about as more of a disease than, you know, a moral failing. But authorities' response to fentanyl has in many ways intensified the war on drugs and intensified it more severely than I think we've seen in a very long time.
Well, let's look at a more positive element of this has come out in your books, which is the role of activists in changing the narrative and trying to get people to think differently, everyone from, you know, users to communities to the police. Let's start with Jess Tilley in Massachusetts. Could you tell us a little bit about Jess and their work?
Yeah, Jess is a remarkable woman who I actually found in Boston on a book tour for my first book. She was actually assigned to introduce me for a talk I was giving about my book. And part of that event was to establish a demo supervised injection facility within the hospital that we were speaking at. And there were no instructions to build this thing. And we had a really hard time putting it together and got to know each other that way. And I quickly learned that this woman who used drugs, this woman who has experienced some trauma in her life, is accomplishing some of the most incredible things that I'd heard about. She established a drug user union in Boston many years ago, sort of an organization of people who use drugs that acts just like a labor union, sort of lobbying for their rights and that sort of thing. She's pioneered underground sort of guerrilla needle exchange in that region back when needle exchange was still illegal in certain jurisdictions. Jess would figure out how to order a large supply of needles, stuff a backpack full, and go out in the evenings and find places where those clean syringes were needed and save people from HIV that way. And now, working with a second activist that I talk about in my book, Louise Vincent in North Carolina, the two of them have taken efforts like that to the national level and are organizing drug users across the United States and organizing them to speak in Washington at that federal level, saying, we as drug users do not want to be left out of this conversation anymore. We want a seat at the table.
When you speak to these activists, are they also beginning to have a welcome inroad into the debate within cities, how the media responds, how civic authorities respond, how services, health services respond? Are they finding that people, once they come forward with their stories and with a real life example of what needs to be done, that people are more willing to listen?
Well, they are gaining that voice, but you use the word welcoming, and I don't know if that's the word I would use to describe it. People who use drugs have to fight very hard for a seat at these tables, especially in the United States. And they are often not welcome and have to obtain those seats by demanding them, by occupying, you know, local government chambers, by speaking to newspapers and shaming people. Stigma against drug use is intense in the United States, far more intense than it is in Europe. And I learned far more intense than it is in Canada. You know, coming from Canada to the United States, I sort of knew, you know, this is where the war on drugs started. This is where it's most intense. This is where they, you know, they really fight it with violence. And after a little bit of time with Jess Tilley and Louise Vincent, I learned I previously had no idea. The war on drugs is a scary thing in the United States. You know, in Vancouver, Canada, activists can establish an illegal injection site and call the media down and sort of shame local governments into establishing healthcare programs for drug users that way, and the police will not come for them. If you establish an illegal injection site in America, you are going to jail. That's the reality of the war on drugs here. So it's very different than in Canada and in Europe. It has not softened to the degree that I think a lot of people are starting to believe. And that affects how people who use drugs gain a seat at these local tables where we're talking about a response to the overdose crisis. It is not an easy thing what Jess and Louise are accomplishing. It involves a lot of sacrifices, and it involves fighting what is still a lot of stigma in America.
Travis Lupik, thank you so much for joining us. And Light Up the Night, America's Overdose Crisis and the Drug Users Fighting for Survival, is out now via The New Press. Next, we travel to Philadelphia, just one of the cities in the US that battles with daily overdoses on its streets. But there is one organisation that is promoting drug harm reduction in the city with needle exchange services. Its executive director, Jose Benitez, pushed unsuccessfully for supervised injection sites in the city in 2019, and we'll hear more about these later on. Prevention Point Philadelphia is that organisation, and it's located in the Kensington area, a historically underserved and impoverished community in the city. Prevention Point is a harm reduction organisation, and it's also one of the largest syringe service programmes in the country. Well, I'm joined now by Chad Gurgel, a medical social work coordinator at Prevention Point Philadelphia. Chad, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Can I start with the area your organisation operates out of, Kensington? What's the situation in that part of the city right now?
For Kensington specifically, there's a lot of recent media attention over the last decade or so. There's lots of articles. The Times did a report calling it the Walmart of heroin, you know, the largest open air drug market in the country, which is a little bit misleading. However, there is no denying that we are in an overdose and mass poisoning epidemic. I personally strive away from saying we're in an opioid crisis or an opioid epidemic and really sort of focus on the reality, which is that people are dying. People are using untested, unregulated substances every day, and it's leading to the loss of a lot of lives. You know, COVID has made a lot of changes to the drug supply, just in like increased pressure at the borders. Any sort of disruption and change to the drug supply really has ramifications in our population. We're seeing a rise of amputations, skin and soft tissue infections. Not a whole lot of research done on this right now, but anecdotally, a lot of it is due to the presence of, you know, what we call in the street tranq or xylazine, which is an additive to the dope supply here. It's a public health crisis right now, just the fact that, you know, folks are injecting unregulated substances, and this presence of xylazine has really sort of changed the game for the work that we do.
Now, tell me, you know, obviously they come to you, they get some compassion, they get some empathy, but when they step out of your processes and out of your world and they bump up against the police or housing authorities, is there much empathy out there in the rest of the city? How does somebody who says they have an issue with drugs and is concerned about their drug use, how else do they interconnect with services in the city?
It really does ebb and flow. You know, I've only been doing this work for a handful of years, so I can't really speak to what it was like a decade ago, for example, but historically, both in the legal system, the housing system, the medical system, folks that inject drugs or folks that use drugs have been historically pushed away and denied services for the simple fact that they use drugs. So we can treat them. And that is one of the most rewarding thing about the work that we do every day, is that in a lot of ways, and participants will tell us this, that they don't get this kind of treatment anywhere else they go. And for one, that's very rewarding. It makes us happy that we're able to provide the service that they don't get anywhere else, or just this compassion that they don't get anywhere else. But that's also really infuriating that, you know, if I want to make a referral to one of my participants that desperately needs hospital attention, I can't guarantee them that they're going to get the kind of compassion and treatment that they get within our building.
But would you find, for example, you know, the police services or the judicial services referring people back to you down the line saying, look, you know, so you don't keep on bumping into being arrested or being hassled on the street, why don't you go to PPP and seek out the help of somebody like Chad?
Sure. There has been shifts in that regard. Prevention Point has a police-assisted diversion program, for example, where somebody could be picked up on a nonviolent possession charge and be, instead of arrested and processed, they will be taken to our other satellite location, which is our PAD office, police-assisted diversion, and we'll make those social referrals, whether the person wants to go to inpatient treatment or they want to do outpatient with us, or, you know, maybe they are looking to get their hepatitis C treatment and start working on the housing process. So there is systems in place. But with all that being said, at the end of the day, the legal system, the laws are the laws, and our population is still routinely having to interact with police for sleeping on the street, for injecting, for possession charges. They are still stuck in the system, despite any changes that have been made.
You know, obviously, the war on drugs, we wouldn't be having this conversation now if it had been successful in recent years at quelling the market, the desire, the prevalence of drugs in our society. As an organisation, what's your kind of approach? Is to say, look, this is something we will always live with. It's how you manage the situation. Or do you think that there is a case for trying to curtail drugs in our cities? What's your approach?
To sort of echo a sentiment that would be in all levels of Prevention Point, that drug use is not wrong. Not only is it not a crime, it's not wrong. And an area that I'm very passionate about is the access to MAT, medication-assisted treatment. That is the program that I run here at Prevention Point. And even within that small subset of this, in other organizations that provide MAT, there is this idea that buprenorphine, methadone, for example, are these sort of short-term interventions that are granted to individuals who are still actively using opioids to kind of wean them off, so to say. You know, this is a temporary intervention because ultimately where you need to be is total abstinence. We don't have that approach here. You know, I talk to everyone that comes into our program, and if somebody wants to be on buprenorphine for the rest of their lives, not only is that okay, they'll be supported in that. And for a lot of individuals, they do need access to this medication for the rest of their lives. So I guess to boil all of that down, you know, the work that we do is centered around this idea that drug use does not have to be dangerous. Drug use does not have to ruin your life. Drug use can be something that you live with, and there's ways to keep you safe if you choose to continue.
It's a very nuanced and complicated and demanding idea for many people. The thought that you see drug use in your city and you don't try and stop it, you say, this is just something that happens. Let's try and make it happen in a safer way. Now, whether there are halfway houses or places where you go to exchange your needles, do you have to lobby a little bit in communities and with neighbourhoods and with council members to get them on board? Because I imagine that's a trickier sell in a way.
It really is. And I think we're very fortunate. You know, Prevention Point is the nation's first legally sanctioned syringe exchange. And it's sort of an institution of Philadelphia. And though there's constant community pressure, you know, there's always voices in the community that don't want us here, that don't want us to provide this work. But at the end of the day, we stand behind the research. We distributed 6.5 million syringes in the last fiscal year. There is work that has been done to look at the impact that our work has had to taxpayers over the past near 30 years that we've been in existence. So that's always something that we stand by, that this is an evidence-based practice. And at the end of the day, we're not only saving our community, you know, the community here in Kensington, but we're also saving taxpayers. We're making Philadelphia at large a better and safer place to live.
The interesting thing is many of the people, I presume, who come to you, although they may be in difficult situations, in desperate situations, I'm sure in many cases, there must be something in their mind that's thought, I need some help here, I need some guidance, I need somebody to have my back. I presume there's another category of people who wouldn't come forward, who would never come into your world. So is your job both outreach and dealing with people who come to you, or is that just too difficult? You have to accept that some people will not come into your fold.
Now, it is really all about a combination of outreach and just being here and being patient. You know, there's a saying that kind of has been around in Prevention Point and really just harm reduction in general, that, you know, people can't recover when they're dead. So we'll provide all the services. We'll have our drop-in center open. And if somebody wants to come in and just watch TV, have a sandwich, pick up some clean syringes and then be on their way, they might do that for 3-6 months. Maybe after 6 months, they really come back in and they say, hey, you know what? I think I'm ready to reduce my fentanyl intake down from 10 bags a day to 5 bags a day. I think Suboxone is the way to do that. They get paired with a case manager. They get access to a provider. So it's this game of being out there, being in the community, talking to people, getting to know and building trust, and also being here and letting the participants steer the boat. When they're ready, they will come to us.
Here you are on the front line of this very difficult story. If you were speaking to a mayor, a civic leader, a council member, what are the things you think that people should have top of mind, whether in Philadelphia or anywhere else in the world, when dealing with drug users, about how you begin to reduce harm and take care of people?
It's one of the things that I really want people to know, is that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to recovery or to really any of this. What breaks my heart at the end of the day, and can speak for a lot of people here at Prevention Point, is we can do all this work to get people access to medical care, to outpatient behavioral health, to MAT. But if somebody is living unsheltered, it's us that have to close the door at the end of the night and tell them that the building is closed now and you have to go back out onto the street. So shifting the focus away from just mandated treatment, mandated recovery, this is what you have to do, and really sort of shift to a housing for all model would really make so much of a difference, you know, drastic impacts to the work that we do and the population that we serve here.
Chad Gurgel from Prevention Point, Philadelphia. Thank you for joining us here on The Urbanist. Finally today, we head to New York, where the ongoing drug crisis has ushered in some innovative but controversial forms of addiction treatment. Here's Monocle's Henry Sheridan with more.
Last November, the first two safe injection sites in the US began operating in New York City. Safe injection sites emerged in Europe about 50 years ago. They're known by many names, including overdose prevention centres, drug consumption facilities, and harm reduction centres. And there are many misconceptions about how they operate. To find out how they actually function, I spoke to Jamie Lister, an assistant professor at Rutgers University who researches addiction treatment and access to care. Just explain for me the most basic services that these facilities provide in general.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think in the public, there's still not a great conception of what happens here. I think first and foremost, they're a safe place for people to use or consume drugs. By safe, meaning that they have access to sterile syringes. They could have access to testing strips that could detect if there was fentanyl in the opioids, as well as they could be advised on safer ways to inject that reduce the risk of infections or slow down kind of the intensity of drug use. Beyond that, they're also safer because there's on-site clinicians or peers who could administer overdose reversal medications in the instance that somebody is having an overdose, whereas in the community, it might be too late by the time medical responders arrive to save someone's life. The other benefit at these places is that they also can offer folks access to other services, housing, drug treatment, and kind of make a connection and build rapport there in the process of that supervised use.
And explain how these facilities have spread across the world. What kinds of nations and cities have adopted them?
You know, they've largely spread across Europe. So there's approximately 120 of these sites right now across the world, but they're concentrated almost exclusively in European nations, Canada and Australia. You know, currently the United States only has two, but those two are relatively recent. At the end of November of 2021, they became official. And I would, if I had to describe where, it's been big cities that have perhaps borne more of the burden of the overdose epidemic and potentially have more progressive ideas about healthcare, so more awareness of why these facilities could be helpful. In the last year, the United States experienced a roughly 30% increase in the overdose death rate during the COVID pandemic. As a result, I think more and more policymakers have come to the kind of realization that the prior models aren't working and that innovation is required. I still think that on the whole, whether it's leadership or public, needs a better understanding about addiction, how it works, what the physiological dependence process looks like, why harm reduction services are not only helpful in the short term, but in the long term, how there's evidence to show they link folks to treatment, they reduce the likelihood of overdose deaths, spread of infectious disease. I think for the most part, there's still a barrier to people thinking that these are kind of just unregulated places to use drugs and that harms will come afterwards. But that's not been the case in the studies.
Both of the New York safe injection sites are located in northern Manhattan, one in Harlem and one in the adjacent Washington Heights neighborhood. But the reasons for this concentration have less to do with rational planning and more to do with the power struggles of New York City politics.
My name is Sideria Asbury Cresfield. I'm currently a co-founder of the Greater Harlem Coalition. We're a coalition of about 6,000 residents, community leaders, and small businesses devoted to improving the quality of life and safety in Harlem. So we work to have a neighborhood where our children can thrive.
So let's talk specifically about these two relatively new safe injection sites that have been set up in Harlem. The Greater Harlem Coalition has objected to these sites. What are the specific reasons for your objection to them?
It's not so much that we're objecting to the site. I mean, we're objecting to the fact that there was no community input into where the site was being placed or if we wanted the site located in Harlem at all. I mean, our opinions are often ignored and we feel these types of social services are dumped in communities of color for the benefit of wealthier and wider neighborhoods. So our community boards were not consulted even after declaring a moratorium on the placement of these drug facilities in our community. And the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene gave a presentation to Community Board 11, where the site is now located, on the topic of harm reduction and overdose prevention a couple of weeks before the site was actually opened. And not once did they say they were placing a safe injection facility in the neighborhood. And even after the site was opened, their grand opening that Sunday, the Department of Health still denied that a new site was opening in the district. I mean, they blatantly lied to the community board with a total lack of regard or respect for the community. And this is something that happens in our community all the time. Just to give you just a bit of history. So Black and Brown communities, we've been saddled with these opioid treatment programs since the 70s. And when these types of programs, specifically the methadone clinics, were first opened in the gentrifying area of Fort Greene, the white homeowners there fought to have it moved to Bed-Stuy, which is a low-income, predominantly Black neighborhood, because they said it was turning Fort Greene into a ghetto. So using their wealth with the help of politicians and over-policing, they were able to shut that methadone center down. So it was reopened in Bed-Stuy, where there was little pushback. And soon afterwards, other OTPs were opened in other neighborhoods of color like Bushwick and Brownsville and Harlem, because there's always little political involvement in the opening of these sites. And even when the politicians do know they're coming, they never notify the community. So Harlem has struggled with drug dealing and the use of drugs for decades, but it's never been this bad. And it wasn't until we started requesting data did we realize why Harlem is the way it is. Because the data showed that each day, over 7,000 people come to Harlem for drug treatment. And some of these people leave and go to work or back home. But then you have those that stay, the vulnerable people, they stay and they hang out all day. And that attracts the drug dealers. So if we had smaller treatment capacity, mostly reserved for our residents, then the number of drug dealers would go down and our quality of life would improve.
Presuming safe injection sites are here to stay in NYC, what do you think would be the most equitable way, or at least a more equitable way, of distributing them across the city?
Well, like I mentioned with the data, last year we applied for a Freedom of Information Law request. It's called a FOIL request from the Office of Alcohol and Substance Abuse Services, which is OASIS. And we learned from that information that 75% of the patients that receive their treatment in Harlem and East Harlem, they do not live here. So we can use that report or something similar, which lists these patients by zip codes, to open methadone and other harm reduction and human service programs unwanted by other wealthier communities, so that we can distribute them more evenly throughout New York City. I mean, why should we have people in need of services travel an hour, 2 hours to get their services in Harlem, when it's been proven that the shorter the distance a person has to travel for assistance, the greater their chance of overcoming addiction? People come from as far away as Westchester and Staten Island, where there's a heavy addiction problem. I mean, they need to end treatment segregation based on income and race and offer all addiction patients equal access to the best and most effective treatment options available. All we're asking for is fair share distribution.
For Monocle 24 in New York, I'm Henry Reese Sheridan.
Well, I hope it's both been instructive and no doubt a little bit sobering to tap into this story that is affecting cities around the world, but especially in the US, and to hear people, even if you disagree with them, who are trying to change the narrative and who don't believe a simple war on drugs is going to change what's happening in our cities. We see the crisis in opioids making it into TV shows, into films, and being debated ever more. But I think what's instructional about what we've heard today is that these activists don't think that people maybe like you and me can change what's happening unless we speak to the people who are the users and begin to treat them as people and understand some of the things that will mitigate both harm and their use potentially in the future of drugs. So a tough show, but I hope one that leaves you with some optimism too, that there are people out there who aren't just letting this go and who believe that change is possible. That's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Rebello and David Stevens. And David also edited the show. And to play you out this week, here's The War on Drugs with Thinking of a Place. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. Night.